deed, then drive back without anyone knowing. Very easy, I'd say. No. No! I pushed myself out of the chair, knocking it over with a clatter. You can't actually believe that. No! My pulse soaring. Sweat covering my brow. This is like a bad dream. This can't be happening. You did this, Isaac. You think I don't know what's going on?
Oh, Murphy. I think you know exactly what's going on.
Two officers, uniforms whose names I've forgotten, step into the room. Isaac nods to them. Cool and collected, he is having the time of his life.
Jenna Murphy,
he says.
You're under arrest for the murders of Annie Church and Dee Dee Paris.
Chapter 97. Noah watches and waits. 2 hours pass while the midnight air moves from brisk to cold. He's underdressed in his black sweatshirt and black baseball cap and black jeans. They may not keep him warm, but they serve another purpose. Nobody can see him in the dark. He hears a noise, probably just the wind, and scrapes his cheek against one of the shrubs. He's been crouched low for a long time, so he stretches out, kicking out one leg at a time, like a sprinter preparing for a race, so he'll be loose when the time comes. No police, no security. Probably a burglar alarm on the outside door. But on the window? Well, let's find out. He steps out into the clearing, a small expanse of grass behind the building, but still outside the reach of the overhanging lights, still in the dark, still invisible. The window has iron bars over it. He'll deal with the bars if necessary, but first he wants to see if the window has an alarm. He raises his tire iron to eye level, angles it through the bars, and jams it against the glass. The glass shatters, an unmistakable sound, but not a very loud one, especially with a light wind. And really, nobody should be around right now, past midnight in an empty industrial park. After shattering the glass, Noah steps back, ready to retreat into the darkness. He hears no glass shatter alarm, no police sirens. But there could be an alarm on the window itself, triggered when it's opened. So he tries that next, slipping his hand between the iron bars, carefully through the half-shattered window, until he finds the interior latch. He unlocks the window. Then, with both hands, he pushes it up from the bottom frame. A few more shards of glass fall onto the floor inside. But no alarm sounds. The window is not armed. They must have figured the iron bars were enough. They figured wrong. Noah shines his flashlight on the screws. They are deeply embedded, some of them rusted. They won't be easy to unscrew, but his cordless drill will get the job done sooner or later. It will make some noise, but nothing too loud. And he's out here alone. He just needs to hurry. Noah puts on his rubber gloves, then he fits the drill bit into the first screw and gets to work.
Chapter 98. Hey there. I'm sitting upright against the wall in a holding cell beneath the substation, on a mattress about as thick and comfortable as a piece of paper, my thoughts scattering about. My head turns toward the cell bars, toward the voice. Lauren Ricketts, in uniform, giving me a sympathetic smile. Had to wait until the chief went home, she says. He didn't want anyone visiting you, least of all me. I push myself off the wall, pain running down my neck and back. What the hell's going on, Murphy? She asks. How can this be right? That's all I've been thinking about. No clue, I say. No freaking clue. These girls were murdered in 2007. I wasn't even here in 2007. I didn't come here until last year, 4 years later. But you can't prove that, she says. How can I prove I never came here? I throw up my hands. Like Isaac said, nobody knows when specifically those two girls were murdered. June? July? August? There's no specific day or even month that the murders happened. So how can I produce an alibi? Am I supposed to have an alibi for every single day of the entire summer of 2007? It's impossible. Oh, Murphy, what a clusterfuck. And this hunting knife they found, the murder weapon? I haven't so much as touched a hunting knife since I came back here. I'm not sure I've ever held one in my life. I mean, it's not physically possible. Ricketts doesn't have an answer for that. Neither of us does. What about Aiden? I ask. They're looking for him? Oh, yeah. His prints on the weapon? The bodies behind his property? And we heard from East Hampton PD about what happened at Justin's house last night. The attack. There's a manhunt. We have to find him, Lauren, I say. We have to find Aiden. Believe me, we're trying. No, I mean we have to find him. Isaac doesn't want Aiden found. He's the one who told Aiden to leave. And if he does find Aiden, he'll kill him. You know, make it look like a shootout with a suspect or something. He wants Aiden gone or dead. So Aiden will take the fall all by himself. Ricketts looks at me, doubt creeping into her eyes. Jenna, you think I'm wrong? She lifts her shoulders. I'm not sure. Are you so sure it's Isaac? That Isaac's a killer? That he framed you for this? I'm not sure of anything anymore. Aiden, Isaac, Noah, or some combination thereof. My fingerprints magically appearing on murder weapons without my knowledge? I feel like I'm in the Twilight Zone. The fingerprint match was clean, Ricketts says. I found the murder weapon, that hunting knife, myself, and I delivered it directly to our forensics team. I watched the guy run the analysis, Murph. Isaac didn't tamper with that. So how could Isaac get your fingerprints on the knife? How could anybody? But somebody did. Probably easier for him than anybody else. Ricketts steps back from the cell bars, her focus dropping to the floor. You don't believe me, I say. She shakes her head slowly. I'm not ready to believe our chief of police is a serial killer. No. I stare at her. She looks suddenly uncomfortable, shifting her weight from one foot to the other. He got to you, I say. He told you what a great job you're doing, how a big promotion could be in the works, a bright future. But just watch out for Jenna Murphy. Don't believe anything she says. She's bad news. She'll take you down. Is that about it, Officer Ricketts? No, that's not it. Some steam in her voice, color to her face. I'm following the facts wherever they lead. Including my prints being found on that hunting knife. Yeah, including that. Her eyes rise to meet mine. A gulf between us suddenly. The cop on the one side, the suspect on the other. So we're done? I say. You and me? I told you, Murphy. I'll follow the facts wherever they lead. Another one bites the dust. First Noah, now Ricketts. My team has been reduced to a team of me, myself, and I. Then I have some facts for you to follow, I say. Aiden's mother, Gloria Willis. Yeah? She was killed in a hit and run, I say. Find out when. She thinks about that, nods. I can do that. And while you're at it, I say. Find out whether Isaac or Noah Walker was adopted. Chapter 99. Joshua Brody, once Noah Walker's attorney and now mine, walks into my holding cell as Lauren Ricketts leaves. He looks around and then looks at me. Thanks for coming in the middle of the night, I say.
Part of the job.
He scratches the back of his neck, his eyelids heavy. He looks around again.
So is this the cell where Noah supposedly confessed to Chief James?
I shake my head. I'm not in the mood. Joshua beat me up pretty good over that during the cross-examination. Talk to me, I say.
The arrest is solid,
he says.
Your prints on the murder weapon are sufficient for probable cause.
We don't know it's the murder weapon, I counter. They don't have DNA back yet. We don't know that it's Annie's and Dee Dee's blood on the knife. Brody looks at me like he would look at a child who just doesn't get it.
The hunting knife was covered in blood and was found with the bodies,
he says.
You're right. They haven't conclusively tied the knife to the dead girls, but come on. Dead women with stab wounds, a bloody knife found inside.
Did they die of stab wounds? I thought their skulls were crushed.
I don't know,
he says.
Autopsy's tomorrow. But whatever the cause of death, they have sufficient evidence for an arrest. Remember, they don't have to show guilt beyond a reasonable doubt until trial.
The trial? I can't believe it. I'm going to be tried for murder?
You have to get me out of here,
I say.
Best I can do is try to get a reasonable bond,
Brody says.
The hearing's tomorrow. But on 2 counts of murder, it will be hard. If you get bond at all, it will be $1 million, maybe 2 million, which means you'll need to come up with 10%. 100,000, 200,000, whatever.
Noah Walker bonded out. He was charged with a double murder.
Noah Walker had a girlfriend for whom $1 million was pocket change. I don't suppose you have a trust fund or anything like that.
I let out a bitter laugh. I have a little bit of money saved up, but nowhere near that kind of scratch.
I'll come back tomorrow,
Brody says.
Unless there's anything else I can do.
I drop my head against the wall. But then it comes to me. There is one thing. You're a lawyer, I say.
Last I checked, yeah.
Maybe you can help me with something, I say. Chapter 100.
Joshua Brody rubs his unshaven face, mulling over everything I've just told him. So you think the 6th and last Holden Dahlquist had a son? A son who's running around killing people?
That's my theory, yes. A pretty good one, I think.
And you think this boy is the younger half-brother of Aiden Willis, the other person whose prints were found on the knife?
Yes. The half-brother was abandoned at birth. But somehow, in some way, he was able to discover his biological father, or vice versa.
So you figure there might be some records of this. Maybe the biological mother filed a paternity suit. Or there'd be adoption records. Or both.
Something, I say. But whatever it may be, I'm pretty sure
it would involve his attorney,
Brody says.
Yes, I agree with that much. If a guy like Holden Dahlquist had a problem like that, his first call would be to his lawyer. Sure.
So that's why I'm asking about his attorney, I say.
Okay. Well, to answer your question, these days most files are stored electronically. But Holden the 6th, as you call him, he died when again?
He died sometime in 1994, I say.
Okay.
Brody nods.
So any records would be no later than 94. And back then, nobody was creating the kind of electronic files we have today. There would be hard copies.
Hard copies? That's what I thought. That's what I was hoping. Where would those hard copies be?
Something that old, they would be in off-site storage,
he says.
But it's not like you have access to them. These are attorney-client documents. You'd need a court order.
Then let's get one.
On what grounds? Your hunch?
Yes, my hunch. He shakes his head.
It would be hard, nearly impossible.
How long would it take?
Very long. Months. There'd be a vicious court battle.
I don't have months, Mr. Brody. I have to know this now.
Murphy,
he says,
you haven't even been indicted yet. When you are, there will be a court case, and maybe we can explore that. But now, right now, no chance. Zero.
I deflate. He's making sense, I know it. It would take months to get court-approved access to those files, if they even exist at all. Unless... Just out of curiosity, I say, where would the law firm keep its old hard copies of files?
Oh,
Brody shrugs.
Most law firms around here use a place out in Riverhead called Dunbar Professional Storage.
Dunbar Professional Storage in Riverhead. I know the name of Holden the 6th's lawyer, I say. A guy named Phineas Rucker.
Do you know him? I knew him, says Brody. He died a few years ago. Cancer, I think.
I deflate. But I looked up his law firm online. Rucker, Rice, and Spong.
Yeah, his firm still exists, but he doesn't.
But his firm would still have the records.
Brody nods. I'm sure they do.
Well, do you have any idea if his firm uses that storage facility?
Brody's eyes narrow. No, I have no idea. But like I said, wherever they keep those records, you'd have to go through a judge.
Absolutely, I say.
Don't get any dumb ideas. You're in enough trouble already.
Of course. Dunbar Professional Storage in Riverhead. Remember that. That's my next stop. If I ever get out of this jail cell.
Chapter 101. Noah removes the third iron bar from the window and decides it's enough. He tosses his cable cutters in through the open window. He stuffs the flashlight into his front pocket. Using the remaining iron bar as a brace, he hauls himself up and onto the window ledge. His head through the open window, his body dangling outside, he looks around. It's dark, but he can see enough to get the drift. An office, a desk covered in paper, a chair, file cabinets. He has no choice but to fall in headfirst. He can't see the floor, but he knows it's littered with broken glass now. He lunges forward and catches the chair to break his fall. But fall, and fall hard, he does. An awkward landing, his jeans doing enough to protect him from the glass. Could have been a lot worse. He brushes himself off and turns on his flashlight for a second. Then he opens the locked office door, looks beyond it. Darkness until he finds the light switch. And then, a warehouse, a wide and long and high expanse of space filled with nothing but rows and rows of shelving, a rolling ladder in each row to reach the higher shelves. He looks around long enough to get his bearings. Then he kills the lights. Those overhead lights are no good. Someone could detect an intruder from a mile away. With his flashlight, he roots around the office and finds the index. He leafs through it until he finds what he's looking for. Then he walks into the warehouse, his footsteps echoing, the space pitch dark except for the beam from his flashlight. He finds the right row and then the right shelf. He's ready to break a lock with the cable cutters, but there aren't any locks on the doors. Even better. He riffles through the files, the flashlight in his mouth. It takes him longer than expected, the risk of detection growing with each moment that passes. When he finds it, he flips through the pages briefly. Time does not permit a thorough review, shining his flashlight over each page before he closes it up, the story from the newspaper on top. Newborn abandoned at police station. He takes the news clipping and the other documents, stuffs them back in the file folder, and places the folder under his arm. Then he closes the doors and climbs down the ladder. He retraces his steps, closing the office door, climbing back out the window, falling into the grass. He scrambles back to his hiding spot in the shrubs and looks over his handiwork. If he had all the time in the world, he could replace the iron bars. But he doesn't. And there's no replacing a shattered window. But that's okay. He didn't leave any prints. He didn't even have to break any locks. The file doors he opened are now closed up, like before, with no evidence that Noah looked inside that door versus any of the other hundreds of doors in the facility. So tomorrow, when the employees of Dunbar Professional Storage arrive at work, they'll know someone broke one of their windows and got inside. But that's all they'll know. They won't know who broke in. They won't know where he looked. And they'll have no idea which files he took.
Chapter 102. The courtroom, filled with media and spectators. The discovery of the Yale students, plus the ex-cop who starred prominently in the Noah Walker case. Too much for the reporters to stay away. I've become tabloid fodder. Justin, sitting in the front row, trying to give me an upbeat expression when I walk into court. I can't bear to make eye contact with him. The lawyers make their arguments. Joshua Brody argues that the evidence against me is weak. The fingerprints on the knife, but that's all. No motive, no evidence that I even set foot on Long Island during the summer of 2007. Sebastian Akers rises for the prosecution. Oh, how he must savor the opportunity to prosecute me. He's never forgiven me for blowing his conviction against Noah Walker.
Of course she's a flight risk, he says. These women were stabbed and her prints are on the knife. It's hard to imagine more direct evidence of guilt, short of capturing the whole thing on video.
The judge, an old guy I've never met named Corrigan, raises his hand.
Bond will be set at $2 million,
he says.
In the event bond is made, the defendant will surrender her passport and will submit to electronic monitoring. She will be restricted to home confinement with waivers for work, attorney or medical visits, religious observation, and household errands under the supervision of the sheriff's office.
The judge bangs his gavel. We won, but we lost. $2 million? That means I have to come up with $200,000 to get out of here. I don't think I have $10,000 in my name, and what little I have is going to Joshua Brody as a retainer to defend me.
I'll pay it,
Justin calls out to me as the courtroom grows noisy.
It'll take me a day or two, but I have it.
I can't ask you to do that, I say. He looks at me, almost wounded.
You didn't ask, he says.
I don't know how to respond. I absolutely hate being dependent on someone else for anything, but I don't have any other options. Before the deputies escort me from the courtroom, my lawyer asks for a moment.
We're lucky to get bond at all,
he says.
Whoever that guy is in the front row, if he's offering to pay it, you should say yes.
But I have to wear an electronic ankle monitor? And home confinement?
It's pretty standard these days,
he says. I know, but then I can't do what I need to do. I'll be trapped.
And Jenna,
he says.
I called that facility, that offsite storage place I use, Dunbar Professional Storage.
Yes?
I perk up. I know someone there. I'm a longtime client. Anyway, Holden's lawyer, Finn Rucker, his firm does use that facility.
I nod. Okay, good.
But you should know something. Someone broke into their facility last night.
What?
I draw back from him. Yeah, broke through a window, removed the iron bars, had the run of the place. So just in case you were getting a dumb idea like breaking into that warehouse, which we both know you were thinking, you should know that they've doubled down on security. They're posting guards around the clock now.
What was taken? I ask.
They don't know. Practically impossible to tell. I think they're doing an inventory, but it's so hard to know. There are literally millions of files there.
He looks at me, cocks his head.
Why? You think this is related to your-
Of course it's related, I whisper harshly. Whoever broke in there, he did it so I wouldn't find those files.
Jenna.
He squeezes my arm.
You're watching too many conspiracy shows.
He took it so I wouldn't find it, I say, realizing that I probably sound paranoid to him. Just another irrational client. The guards intervene, place me in handcuffs, and escort me out. I glance back at Brody, who looks like he's never felt sorrier for anyone. Then I glance at Justin, who looks like he's just lost his best friend.
Chapter 103. Bond was set at $2 million this morning for Jenna Murphy, the former Southampton police detective arrested for the murders of Dee Dee Paris and Annie Church, the Yale sophomores whose disappearance in the Hamptons 5 years ago sparked a massive manhunt. Noah Walker paces back and forth in his living room as the newscast, News at Noon, talks about Murphy and the murders of the Yale sophomores. Noah is exhausted, not having slept last night, after breaking into the storage facility and removing those files. He needs to sleep, he needs to shower, but he can't do anything but think about his next move. He passes the couch, the pile of documents he took from the warehouse. The news clipping with the catchy headline, "Newborn Abandoned at Police Station," which tells most of the story right there. And the letter, aged and dusty, having sat in a file inside that storage facility for the better part of 20 years now. The nice stationery, the fancy letterhead bearing the name of the private investigator hired by Holden the Sixth, with tabs behind the letter, supporting documentation. "Mr. Dahlquist, this private investigation was undertaken on your behalf at the direction of Mr. Phineas Rucker, Esquire, your attorney. This investigation is thus covered by the attorney-client privilege and will remain confidential. You asked us to determine whether a woman named Gloria Willis of Bridgehampton, mother of Aidan Willis, gave birth to a second child approximately 8 years ago." Noah looks away from the documents, thinks of the things Jenna Murphy has said to him over the last few weeks. At the cemetery, when she told him her theory for the first time,
"Holden the Sixth left behind a son," she said, "a son who wants to restart the family tradition."
And yesterday, at the parking lot at Tasty's,
"Were you adopted, Noah?"
"Holden left behind a son. Were you adopted, Noah?" He looks back down at the letter. "The answer to your question is yes. 8 years ago, Miss Willis did give birth to a second child at Southampton Hospital, but left the hospital with her child only hours later without filling out any paperwork. We believe that she abandoned this child later that evening at the Bridgehampton Police substation. See attached news headline." He reads through the packet of information behind the letter, the hospital records, the county adoption records, the photographs. Noah goes upstairs to his bedroom loft, finds the handgun he hasn't held in years, checks it for ammunition, stuffs it in his pants, puts on a clean shirt, pulls it down over the gun. He grabs his leather jacket on the way out and hops on his Harley. Her apartment isn't far, and she's definitely not home. She's in jail, stuck on a $2 million bond. He parks his Harley outside her apartment and approaches it. It's broad daylight, and cars occasionally whisk by on Main Street, but no pedestrians approach. His heartbeat speeds up. Should he do it? Yes. He slams against the door 4 times, 5 times, violent thrusts, wood splintering, sharp pain in his shoulder, until enough of the door frame has been compromised that he can reach inside and unlock the deadbolt and open the knob from the inside. He pushes open the battered door and he's inside Jenna Murphy's apartment. A mess, a train wreck. A timeline on her wall, covering all the murders. Right, he's seen that before. But there's something he hasn't seen before. On her desk beneath the timeline, a newspaper clipping, jagged edges, still with tape attached to all 4 corners, as if she removed it from something. "Newborn abandoned at police station." Noah's heart skips a beat. She knows, he thinks. She already knows. Knowing what he has to do now, wishing it hadn't come to this, he was really starting to like Jenna Murphy.
Chapter 104. Another day in this cramped, drafty jail cell. A special kind of torture for me, listening to the hustle and bustle one floor above me, hearing the police department at work, reminding me of how far I've fallen in such a short time. Isaac wanted it that way. He normally would transfer me to the Suffolk County Jail after my bond hearing, where I'd be placed in administrative segregation because I'm a former cop, who can't be put in with ordinary inmates. But the jail's overcrowded, which gave Isaac the excuse to keep me here. So close and yet so far from the job I once had. The job I loved. Footsteps. Somebody approaching my cell. It's not lunch. I ate a half hour ago. Tea and crumpets, maybe? A complimentary massage? No and no. It's Isaac, staring at me, looking not so happy. I mean, he's not Mr. Sunshine on a good day, but why shouldn't he be happy? He should be dancing a jig the way things are going. He produces a key from behind his back and opens the door. He walks in and sizes me up. I try to put on a brave front, to look like I'm holding up much better than I really am. But I can't hide the dark circles under my eyes. And I haven't showered in 2 days. My hair is flat and oily. My clothes look exactly as they should, like I've slept in them for 2 nights. He doesn't just look unhappy. He looks like he just swallowed a bug. Why the long face, Isaac?
You have the right to remain silent,
he says to me. And then he runs through the rest of the Miranda warnings. I could say them backward by now. Why are you Mirandizing me? I ask.
I want you to acknowledge I've made you aware of your rights,
he says. Fine, done. But fresh Miranda warnings? Only one reason for that. He wants to question me on a new topic.
What happened in 1994?
He asks. I draw back. Why is he asking me about 1994? When I was just a kid. The year that thing happened. When I disappeared, only to be found on the beach by Seven Ocean Drive. The day my parents whisked me away from the Hamptons, never to return during my childhood. 7 hours of hell, Aunt Chloe called it.
There was a missing persons report that summer,
he says.
It lasted less than a day. I saw it myself. July,
I have nothing to say to you, Isaac. Zilch. Isaac steps back. He can't be surprised that I clam up. His face turns tomato red.
I just want you to know,
he says,
that I know you're behind this. I don't know what kind of crap you're pulling here, but I'm gonna figure it out. You may have won this battle, but you won't win the war.
What the hell is he talking about? What battle did I win? As far as I can tell right now, I'm getting the royal crap beaten out of me. He opens his hand.
You're free to leave,
he says. Oh, Justin came through with the money that quickly? Quicker than he thought he could. But this doesn't seem right. Isaac doesn't have any handcuffs. There's a protocol when you bond out. You're transported to the sheriff, who makes arrangements for your home confinement, gets a list of addresses for doctors and lawyers and grocery stores so they can input the coordinates into the GPS. Then someone fits the ankle bracelet on you. But until then, you're still locked up. You're handcuffed and transported.
I said you're free to leave,
he says.
You're being released.
I don't understand. Isaac shoots me a look. He thinks I do understand. He thinks I've pulled some kind of fast one, that I'm just playing dumb.
You're no longer under arrest for the murders of Dee Dee Paris and Annie Church,
he says. My head spins, some strange version of hope floating through me.
The DNA came back on the murder weapon,
he says.
None of the blood on the knife matches those girls. Their stab wounds don't match up with the knife blade either. That knife wasn't used to kill Dee Dee and Annie.
I stand up for the first time, unsteady, certain I'm not hearing this correctly. A bloody knife with both Aiden's and my fingerprints on it, but...
We did get matches on the blood, though,
says Isaac.
Not Dee Dee or Annie, but 2 matches. One of the matches was you, Murphy.
Like the floor has dropped out from beneath me. Like I'm spinning, falling. My blood? My blood on the knife? My prints and my blood? And who else's blood? I manage. You said 2 matches.
You know,
says Isaac, fuming.
You damn well know. Tell me, Murphy. Tell me everything.
But I can't. I don't know. I don't know what the hell is going on.
That knife wasn't used to kill Annie and Dee Dee,
says Isaac.
It was the knife used to kill Holden Dahlquist VI on July 13th, 1994. The same day that you went missing for 7 hours.
Chapter 105. I stumble out of the police station with a bag holding my cell phone, wallet, keys. I don't know what to do. I don't know where to go. I look at my hand, at the inch-long scar across my palm. The only injury they found on me, Aunt Chloe said, after I went missing for 7 hours and then was found on the beach, otherwise unharmed. That scar must have come from the knife. The knife that had my fingerprints on it. It cut my hand. I must have touched it, too. My prints. My blood. On the knife that Holden the Sixth used to kill himself. On July 13th, 1994. I was there. I was there when it happened. What the hell happened that day? Aiden, I think. I need to find Aiden. But how? And whom can I trust at this point? Not Noah. Not Ricketts. Not anymore. Only one person I can think of. I make the call, and not 15 minutes later, Justin's Jaguar pulls up in front of the substation. He pops out. What happened? How'd you get out? I shake my head. It's a long story, a story I don't even understand. Justin, I say, I need someone I can trust. That's a rapidly dwindling population, I'm afraid. Justin nods, a look of concern on his face. Can I trust you? I ask. Only one way to find out. He smiles, then realizes the comment fell flat. He touches my arm. Hey, listen, you know how I feel about you. I haven't made a secret of that. And I know you don't feel quite the same way about me. I know I'm not your type. No, it's not. I'm not dumb, Jenna. And I'm not blind either. But I'm here for you if you need me. Maybe I'll grow on you. Maybe not. But either way, if you need something, you know all you have to do is ask. I hate this. I hate having to rely on someone else, especially for this. Aiden already tried to kill me once, I say. He'd do it again. And someone's working with him. There are people in this town who don't want me to figure this out, and they'll kill to stop me. Justin takes a deep breath, then nods. I'm in, he says. Let's do it. Chapter 106. Justin drives his Jaguar toward his house, having just gotten an earful from me. Okay, he says, glancing at me. So something happened to you here in July of 1994, and you think Aiden had something to do with it? Yes, and someone else did too. Okay, he says. And you think this someone else is Aiden's younger half-brother? Yes, and his father is Holden Dahlquist the Sixth. Justin takes a deep breath. You think Holden the Sixth and his newfound son and Aiden tried to kill you when you were a little girl? Something like that, I say. I don't have it all figured out. Maybe I was there first. Maybe I was a dry run, a test, to see if they could pull it off. Whatever it was, something must have gone wrong because Holden ended up dead, not me. Wow. And now the son is carrying on the legacy. I think so, I say. So the key is, who is Holden's son? Who is the baby abandoned at the police station? Isaac? Noah? Justin shrugs. Can you ask them? They wouldn't admit it. I asked Noah if he was adopted, and he said no. But that doesn't mean he's telling the truth. Or maybe he doesn't know, says Justin. Maybe his parents never told him. Oh, come on. No, seriously, Jenna. How do any of us know that our parents are our biological parents? We take our parents' word for it, right? There are birth certificates, I say. Those are just records. They can be doctored. Or there's a strong physical resemblance. Justin makes a face. Maybe, but not always. I'm not adopted, but I don't look a whole lot like either of my parents. I'm kind of a blend of them. Do you look like your parents? I think about that. Actually, I got my looks and red hair from my Irish great-grandmother. I turn to Justin. Okay, point taken. So you think there might be someone running around with Holden the Sixth's genes and he doesn't even know it? Possibly. Do you think there's some kind of serial killer gene that can be passed down from generation to generation, even without your knowledge? That one is definitely above my pay grade. We have to find Aiden, I say. Aiden's the key to all of this. Okay, so how do we do that? I have no idea. Justin touches my arm. Don't say it. Think. Think. He's right. Think. If I'm Aiden, I say, I don't have much money. I don't have a car. I can't go to airports or train or bus stations. I can't use a credit card for a rental car or a hotel. How do I run? I could hitchhike.
Have you gotten a good look at Aiden? Justin asks. Would you pick him up?
Stranger things have happened. But okay, what else? He could boost a car, I suppose. But I don't have access to that kind of information right now. Recent auto thefts or anything else. I don't have any resources at all.
I'll try not to take that as an insult, says Justin.
You know what I mean. If I'm Aiden, what do I do? If I'm Aiden. If I'm Aiden. Wait. Maybe he didn't run at all, I say. I turn to Justin. Maybe he's right here in town. He's lived here his whole life, right? If he could find a place to hide for a while, it would beat the hell out of traveling somewhere with no money, no resources.
Justin shakes his head.
I slap my hand on the dashboard. Could it be that simple? I can't believe this, I say. But I think I might know where he is.
Chapter 107. Noah jumps onto his motorcycle, his heartbeat racing faster than the bike's engine as he heads across town. He parks his Harley and removes the gun from his pants, placing it inside the saddlebag on his bike. Cops don't like it when you walk into a police station with a handgun. Noah enters the police substation. Someone at the front desk behind a plate of bulletproof glass.
I'm here to see one of the people in the holding cell, he says.
Are you a lawyer? The man asks, though he doesn't seem to think Noah fits that bill.
No, but this is important, he says. Jenna Murphy is...
Jenna Murphy isn't here, the man says.
Oh, where are you holding her?
We're not. She was released half an hour ago.
She was released? On bond?
The officer on duty looks over his glasses at Noah. Sir, whoever you are, I can't give that information to you. He looks outside. She was released half an hour ago. But he saw her car at her house just now. How did she leave? She wouldn't have walked.
Justin, he thinks. She must be with Justin. I need to speak with Isaac, he says. I need to speak with the chief.
Sir, says the duty officer. You can't just waltz in here and demand to speak with the chief.
It's important.
Sir, the chief isn't-
Listen! Noah slaps his hand against the plate of glass. I need to speak with him, and I need to speak with him now! Hey!
Noah turns at the sound of the voice. A uniformed officer approaching him, a young woman, Murphy's friend, the rookie cop Lauren Ricketts.
What's going on, Noah? She says.
I have to talk to Isaac, he says. Right now.
Why? Tell me what's going on.
Noah thinks it over. He doesn't know Ricketts. He has no idea what she knows and what she doesn't know.
No, he says. I'll only talk to Isaac.
Chapter 108. Justin pulls his car into his garage in East Hampton. The garage door grinds to a close behind us.
So tell me, he says. Tell me where you think Aiden is.
Later, I say.
Later? Why later?
My cell phone buzzes. Caller ID says it's Lauren Ricketts. I don't dare answer. I let the call go to voicemail and then play the message on my speakerphone. Murphy, it's Ricketts. I'm not sure what's going on, and I probably shouldn't be calling you, but whatever. I'm calling you. Listen, about 20 minutes ago, Noah Walker had a private conversation with the chief. And the next thing I know, Isaac has issued an APB for you. They think you're with Justin. I look over at Justin, whose face has gone pale. He mobilized the SWAT teams, Murphy. We're coming after you with everything we have.
You should surrender at the station before something bad happens. I can coordinate it with you. Please call me before this gets out of hand.
Justin turns and looks at me, the gravity of what we've just heard sinking in.
He just released you, and now he's after you again?
After talking to Noah, apparently. And here I thought Noah didn't get along so well with the chief. I get out of the car, and Justin follows suit. We go into his house, his beautiful, spacious kitchen.
You said you have a gun,
I say.
Yeah, I do,
he says, still distracted.
Hang on.
And a flashlight, I call out to him as he leaves the kitchen. I take a breath. Isaac and Noah got together, had a nice little chat, and now the STPD is after me with full force. Isaac and Noah. They've made a very public show of not getting along so well. An act? An act I fell for, hook, line, and sinker?
Okay.
Justin returns to the kitchen with not one gun, but two, holding each of them with two fingers, the barrels dangling down. A regular arsenal, I say. But not really. One is a shiny, polished revolver, new and, from the looks of it, unused. The other is a beat-up revolver with a pearl handle, a vintage piece, a .38 special with a very short, maybe 2-inch barrel that is probably 30 or 40 years old.
Take your pick,
he says, placing them gently on the kitchen table. I laugh.
Take my pick?
How old is that .38 special? Justin shrugs.
My dad bought it years ago, probably the 70s. This new one I bought. I assume it works.
You assume? He shakes his head.
Never used it. Bought it for home protection. Some silly notion that I'm safer with it. I have a feeling if I ever had to use it, I'd end up shooting myself in the foot or something.
You're probably right. I choose the shiny new revolver, hold the gun toward the floor, pop open the cylinder, and confirm the presence of rounds in all 6 chambers. Justin looks at all of this like he's scared to death of guns. He probably is. This isn't his thing. He isn't cut out for this. He's a nice guy, a wonderful guy. But he lives in a world where people are decent and gracious. He doesn't live in a world full of bad guys. That's where we differ. That's where we'll always differ. And the flashlight, I say.
Oh, right,
he says. He removes one from a kitchen drawer and hands it to me. Then he claps his hands, as if ready for action, but the paleness of his face suggests otherwise.
Where to?
He asks.
Where do you think Aiden is hiding out?
I stuff the revolver in the back of my pants.
I have to go now, I say.
He looks at me.
Don't you mean we have to go?
No, I mean I have to go. This is my problem, not yours.
Jenna,
you've done enough. You've given me your gun and a flashlight and a ride, but I can't ask for anything else.
For the last time, you didn't ask,
he says. He puts his hands on my shoulders.
You can't do this by yourself. I may not be a veteran police officer or some Navy SEAL. Shit, I wasn't even an athlete. But you can trust me. I'd do anything for you, Detective Murphy. Haven't you figured that out by now?
I look into his eyes. Yes, there's something there, something more than gratitude for all his attempts to help me. Maybe what I feel for him is enough. Maybe. But now is not the time to be gauging my emotions. I have to do this, and I have to do it alone.
I'll just follow you,
he says. Not if I shoot you in the leg. He laughs in spite of the circumstances. Then the doorbell rings. We both turn our heads toward the front door. Justin takes a couple of cautious steps backward and peeks beyond the kitchen, presumably through a window.
Police car,
he says.
East Hampton PD?
Southampton, he says.
That's Isaac Marks at my front door.
Chapter 109.
Shit,
I say, panic swirling inside me.
Shit.
Justin puts out a hand for caution.
I'll take care of it. Stay here.
I should hide.
No place to hide. He'd see you running through the kitchen.
sit tight.
Justin walks out of the kitchen. A moment later, I hear him opening the front door. I steel myself, close my eyes, listen carefully.
Isaac,
he says. My blood goes cold.
Hello, Justin. I'm looking for Jenna Murphy. Is she here?
Here? No.
No, she's not here. Why? Do you know where she is?
No idea, says Justin.
Is everything okay? It's a police matter. When did you last see her?
I dropped her off at her house earlier today, after she was released from custody.
And?
And nothing. That's it. I dropped her off and I drove here.
You drove here? Why not to the restaurant?
A pause.
I'm the boss, Isaac. I come and go as I please. I didn't think I had to get the police department's permission.
You come and go as you please. A pause, this time from Isaac.
You wouldn't be lying to me, would you, Justin? Because you know it's a crime to lie to a law enforcement officer, don't you?
I think I've heard that somewhere, Justin says. Oh, I know. It was on TV. I smile, but don't dare laugh.
You think this is funny?
Listen to me and listen to me very closely. We are actively seeking to bring Jenna Murphy into custody.
She's not who you think she is.
I think she's an honorable and decent person.
Well, she isn't. I'm gonna take her down. The easy way or the hard way, I'm gonna do it. I prefer the easy way, the safe way. But if you're helping her evade us, you become an accessory. You ever heard that term from TV? It means you're just as guilty as she is.
Justin doesn't respond.
I've known you a long time, Justin. Never had a beef with you. You've always been a good egg. And you make the best damn barbecue shrimp on Long Island. So I'm gonna give you one more chance. And think about what I said. You can help us find a dangerous person who's committed some very serious crimes. Or you could lie to me and spend a very long time in prison. And I will personally see to it that you do.
My heart is sinking as Justin himself sinks deeper and deeper into my problems.
I understand.
Justin's tone is cold and flat.
Do you know where Jenna Murphy is?
I hold my breath. I'd come out right now and show myself and spare Justin any further trouble. But if I do, it's game over. I'll never know the truth.
I have no idea where she is,
Justin tells Isaac. Justin returns to the kitchen, his face ashen after Isaac drives away.
Well, that was fun,
he says, trying to maintain a brave front, but he can't even bring himself to smile.
I'm so sorry,
I say. I'm gonna leave now.
I'm going with you.
No. I leave now, you have plausible deniability. I'll scrape the serial number off your gun so it can't be traced back to you. No one will ever know you helped me. But if you go with me, you spend the next decade in prison, assuming you don't get killed.
I don't care.
He touches my arm. I understand the risks, but you need help, and the risk of losing you is worse than... He swallows hard. His eyes fill.
I don't usually... I've never responded to anyone like I do to you.
I step away from him. Justin, you know I can't reciprocate those feelings. I just don't know.
Yeah, I know. But I don't care. You just haven't figured out what a wonderful guy I am yet. You will someday.
I drop my eyes and smile. Still trying to make this easier for me. Maybe he's right. Maybe someday I'll feel about him the same way he does about me. If there is a someday in my future.
At least tell me where you're going,
he says. No, Justin.
Then take my car.
No. They find your car and that's the same thing as you coming with me. You're aiding and abetting. I'll walk. Better I stay off the roads anyway. And I'm in no hurry. I need the sun to go down before I make my move. I'll wait until midnight, probably.
Call me on your cell, then. At least tell me you're okay.
Turning my cell phone off right now, I say, so they can't track me. Justin lets out air, shaking his head.
Oh, Jenna.
The
Don't say goodbye to me. Just tell me this isn't goodbye. I walk up to him and plant a soft kiss on his cheek. This isn't goodbye, I say, before I head out his back door. Chapter 110. My thoughts zigzagging in every direction, trying to make sense of it all. Noah, Isaac, Aiden, not to mention the entire Southampton Town Police Department after me, heavily armed and prepared for combat. But something is telling me that the key to this is Aiden Willis. If I can get hold of him tonight, if I can surprise him and subdue him, I can finally put an end to this. The walk from East Hampton isn't bad. It's about 7 miles, which under different circumstances would be a typical day's jog for me. And it's safer than driving. When you're on foot, you're nimble. You can escape into crowds, cut corners, hide among foliage. You can obscure yourself in any number of ways. The sky overhead is threatening rain, which will royally suck if it happens. But the good news is that in the meantime, it darkens the sky and brings the rough equivalent of nightfall prematurely. I make it to the beach and kick off my shoes and tromp along the sand, the restless Atlantic Ocean to the south, the carefree breeze playing with my hair. I don't look like a fugitive, and unless the police are conducting a beach patrol, I'm practically invisible to them. So I sit in the sand, less than a mile from my destination, watching the foamy tide crash ashore and recede, waiting for the moment to arrive. If my guess about Aiden is right, he's settling in right now, nestled in his hiding spot, his guard slowly lowering. Somewhere in the house at 7 Ocean Drive. At midnight, I make the decision. It's time. Hopefully he's asleep, or at least close to it. Not expecting company in any event. I step out of the sand onto the parking lot and look up at the mansion. No lights are on, no visible sign of life. Not that I expected Aiden to be hosting a party. I walk along Ocean Drive until I reach the front of the house, my nervous system catching up now, sending warning signals to me, filling my chest. Justin's revolver in my right hand, the flashlight in my left. I try the driveway entrance, expecting resistance, planning to push it open and squeeze myself between the twin gates. But it's not locked. I push one side open and enter, then close it back up, without allowing my imagination to wonder why the gate would be open. My breathing erratic, my legs heavy, I walk up the driveway to the fork, to the right, the walk heading up the hill to the house, to the left, the driveway continuing on to the carriage house, or whatever it is. For some reason, I don't take the familiar path, the one I've traveled several times during my investigation, up the sidewalk toward the house. This time, I stay left, remaining on the driveway, walking toward that oversized carriage house. Not knowing why, unable to place it in my brain, but feeling something inside me growing, spreading like poison. And then a flash through my brain like lightning. Walking, shoved from behind, forced forward, wondering what it is. A stable? A garage? A separate house? Where is it he's taking me? Walk. Move. Walk faster, you stupid girl. I suck in a breath. I should turn around now. I know that. If I had any sense, I'd turn and run. Instead, I shine my light forward, just briefly, to see if there's anything in front of me, up the driveway toward the structure. I move slowly. Faster. Walk faster. As I approach it, tall double doors for an entrance. On the ground, at my feet, a long chain with a broken lock. Somebody unlocked this door recently. He's here. Aiden is here. I put my flashlight in my mouth and raise my gun. With my free hand, I pull on the door handle and yank it open. In one motion, I drop to a knee, remove the flashlight from my mouth, and click it on, sweeping it over the space inside. Open air, 2 stories tall. Big, yes, but empty. Empty. Stains on the concrete floor from automobiles, once upon a time. A rack on the wall for tools, though none are present right now.
A carpenter's desk, too. A wooden top with steel legs, with an old saw and a vise on top. Empty. But a different kind of empty. I shine my light along the floor by the desk. There are circles on the floor, dust markings from where the legs of the tool desk rested not long ago. Someone moved that desk, I mumble to myself. Recently. Very recently. Why move it? I shine the light along the floor. In the area where the desk once stood, before being moved, there is a break in the concrete. An outline. A square. Lying on top of it, a short length of rope. I squat down for a closer look. Same color paint, but the surface of the square looks different. I try to pick up the rope, but it's stuck to the floor, attached somehow. And the surface is wood, not concrete. A wooden square with a rope attached to it. I grab the rope, and this time pull on it hard. The wooden square jars loose. What the hell? I pull harder, and the piece of wood pops upward, a burst of cool air escaping from beneath it. A hidden door, I whisper. There's something underneath this floor. Chapter 111. My gun poised, I pull the trapdoor fully open. I turn on the flashlight. Dust particles floating in the beam, aiming it down into the darkness below. A ladder. A wooden ladder leading down several steps to a floor. My lungs thirsting for air, my head spinning. A small tremor spreads through my limbs, immediately turning into a full-scale tremble. My hand shaking so hard I can hardly hold my gun. I don't dare cock the revolver's hammer. Putting the gun in ready position for fear I'll start shooting, maybe even hitting myself. The ladder's so wobbly. I don't know how far down it will go. The boy yelling at me, "Move! Move!" I drop to my knees and suck in air, desperately seeking breath while my lungs seize up. I was here. I was in this carriage house. I went down this ladder. Sweat stinging my eyes, my shirt stuck to my back, my vision spotty, my heart pounding so fiercely I can hardly move. "Move, Murphy," I whisper. "Move." I tuck the gun into the back of my pants. I fish around the open space with one leg until my foot finds a rung on the ladder. I move slowly, hoping to minimize the noise, praying I don't lose my grip. The ladder itself quaking along with my hands, my arms and legs. Darker, the lower I climb. Colder. White noise filling my ears. Bits and pieces of memories. The sounds of the boy's voice taunting me. "Move! Keep moving, stupid girl!" My body shivering so violently. My feet hitting the floor. Something hard. Like marble. I remove my gun and aim it in all directions, spinning, somehow keeping my balance as I shine the flashlight all around. A tunnel. I'm at one end. The other end, I can't see. High ceilings, width sufficient for two, maybe three people to stand side by side. The lightning bolts between my eyes, the fragments coming back. Wearing sandals and the bathing suit Mommy just bought me. A Lion King t-shirt over it. It's so hard to walk in these sandals, especially when the boy pushes me. Afraid that if I fall, he'll get mad. Afraid of what he might do to me. Stepping forward gingerly, every forward advance and effort, half blind from the sweat burning my eyes, electricity filling my body. I don't understand what is happening. Why this boy is making me go down here? Where are we going? Where are we going? The beam of my flashlight dancing along the floor, the walls, the ceiling. And then I see it. A wall. The end of the tunnel. A doorknob. I tuck the flashlight under my left arm, my left hand holding a wobbly gun. With my right, I reach for the knob. I steel myself.
You can do this, I tell myself. I turn the knob slowly, then whip the door open. Chapter 112. I point the gun inside the room, my pulse pounding against my temples. The smell of bleach and burning oil. A square, windowless room, a single kerosene lamp on one side casting flickering orange light about. Next to the lamp, a sleeping bag, unfolded, but nobody inside it. Nobody in this room, period. No chairs or furniture or anything except something near the back. A spear, protruding from the floor, a long, narrow missile with a sharp top. No, I say. No. Hot tears blurring my vision, running down my cheeks into my mouth. I step into the room, my words echoing between my ears, the walls moving, the room spinning, the cries, the horrific, ghoulish screams from all directions filling my head. My legs unsteady as I move forward. As I move toward the other end of this square room. Because somehow I know. Some internal compass is directing me. Some force is moving me toward a door at the other end of the room. A door I can't see, but that I know. Somehow, I know is there. Everything's slowing down, like I'm moving through quicksand. But I must reach the door. I have to reach it for some reason. But my legs are suddenly numb. Up is down. Down is up. The floor is suddenly rising up to meet my face with a violent smack, sending shockwaves through my skull, jarring the roots of my teeth. The revolver bounces out of my hand on impact with the floor. Everything fuzz and fog. But I can't let go now. Can't. Let go now. The flashlight underneath me, I fell on it. But the gun, I need the gun. My head lifting off the floor, searing pain over my right eye, nausea rising to the surface. I'm woozy and disoriented, patting the floor around me, forcing myself to my knees, light flickering in and out from the glow of the kerosene lamp. The gash over my eye making me pay a severe price every time I whip my head from one side to the other. But I need the gun. Words screaming at me, but I can't make them out. So loud that I can't hear them. Echoing through my head with such force that I can't understand them. What is he saying? What is he? Come with me. Footsteps coming from the other side of the room. Near the door, I can't see. Footsteps. Someone's coming. Come with me. Come with me. The gun. I need the gun. Where is that gun? The click of a doorknob. The groan of a door opening. And Aiden Willis walks in. Chapter 113. Aiden, the scarecrow hair sticking out from his baseball cap turned backward. His features lit up with the flickering orange light, holding something in his hand. A thermos, closing the door behind him. I hold my breath, hold my body still, searching for the gun only with my eyes. There, I spot it. Justin's revolver, over by the wall. Oh! Aiden jumps upon seeing me on the floor to his left. The thermos falls from his hand, clanging and bouncing on the ground. He falls against the wall and struggles to keep his balance. I slide my body toward the far wall and grab the revolver, cock the hammer. What? How? What are you? I grip the gun with both hands, trembling so fiercely that I couldn't possibly aim properly. My insides on fire, my head ringing, nausea and bile at my throat, oxygen coming in tiny, thirsty gulps. The door opens. Bright light streaming in, and a boy with scarecrow hair. With some reserve energy I didn't know existed, as if I'm watching someone else perform the task, I rise to my knees and aim the gun toward Aiden. Aiden's eyes go wide. He looks ghoulish in the intermittent orange light, pinned against the wall, watching me.
lightning, thunder between my ears. Come with me. Come with me. The gun so unsteady in my hand, rising and falling, swaying back and forth. Aiden watching me, watching the gun bob up and down, back and forth. Tears filling my eyes again, my chest heaving, my throat so full I can't speak. Come with me. Sobbing and shaking, the gun moving all over the place. Aiden watching me, watching the gun. Come with me. The gun dropping to my side. I can't do it. I know it and Aiden knows it. Aiden pushes himself off the wall, straightens himself. Looks at me just for a single moment, those darting eyes making contact with mine. Come with me. Then he walks toward me. No sudden movement, just slowly approaching me. Come with me. The boy with the scarecrow hair. Aiden places a hand over my gun hand, then carefully removes the revolver from it. I look up at him, on my knees, helpless. He uncocks the revolver, points it upward, pops open the cylinder and empties all 6 rounds from the chamber into his cupped hand. He locks the cylinder back in place and hands the unloaded gun back to me. Aiden, wait, I manage, my throat full, my words garbled. Then Aiden Willis disappears through the door from which he entered. Please, wait, I say as I get to my feet, the synapses not firing properly. But I managed to stumble and stagger toward the door.
Chapter 114. Noah Walker sits on his idling Harley down the street from Justin's house in East Hampton. He's logged a lot of miles tonight looking for Jenna Murphy, driving loops around Bridgehampton, hitting some familiar spots like Murphy's apartment, Tasty's, the dive bar, even Aiden's house, but always doubling back here to Justin's place. Because Justin's the best bet for finding her. Jenna was last seen, according to Isaac, being picked up outside the police station by someone driving a Jaguar, which almost assuredly means Justin, and it would make sense she'd call him. They aren't together right now, apparently because all Justin has done for the last couple of hours is pace back and forth in his living room. There he is, right now, standing close enough to the window on the west side of his property that Noah can see him, checking his watch, pacing, running his hands through his hair, nervous, anxious. Maybe it's time to drive around some more, do another loop. He jumps at the sight of Justin's garage door lifting. A moment later, the Jaguar pulls out of the driveway, backing up not far from where Noah rests on his Harley. This is it. He's sure of it. He waits until Justin has turned off his street before he starts up his bike and drives. He turns in the same direction as Justin and follows him from a distance, only a small amount of traffic on the roads, but sufficient to hide his presence. Justin travels west on Main Street toward Bridgehampton. Noah keeps his distance, considers even killing his lights, but he sees no indication that Justin knows he's being followed. If only he knew where Justin was going. If he knew that, he could. Justin's car slows near the cemetery. He puts on his signal for a right turn. Wait. Wait a second. He's heading for Ocean Drive. Sure, of course. He's going to that house. And I know a shortcut. I can beat him there. Noah veers off Main Street and drives his bike across the open field of the cemetery, taking a straight line instead of the right angle Justin is forced to take by driving on the streets. Noah crosses through the south end of the cemetery and hits Ocean Drive before Justin has even turned off Main Street. With a good 2 blocks lead on Justin, he kills the lights on his bike and guns it forward, making sure he'll arrive at the mansion at least a full minute before Justin. He stops at a group of trees just off the street, very close to the mansion. He looks back, seeing the headlights of a car in the distance, heading his way. He removes his gun and flashlight from his saddlebag. Then he ducks into the shrubbery across the street from the mansion and waits. Only moments later,
the Jaguar pulls up in front of the mansion. Justin gets out of his car without any sense that Noah is nearby or that he's been followed, jogging up to the mammoth gate blocking the driveway. He grabs it, then pushes it open and heads onto the driveway. Noah creeps closer, obscured by darkness in soft grass, watching Justin. Justin jogs slowly up toward the dark house, looking at it, looking as well at the old carriage house at the end of the driveway. Noah crosses the street and hides behind the Jaguar. Justin, at a crossroads, decides to head up the driveway toward the carriage house. Noah slinks up to the gate by the curb and pushes it open as softly as he can. A flashlight comes on, Justin illuminating the space in front of him. Noah sees what Justin saw, the reason he chose to head up the driveway. The door of the carriage house is wide open. Justin starts jogging toward it, while Noah follows, moving at a slightly faster clip, closing the distance but taking care not to announce himself.
Jenna!
Justin calls out in a harsh whisper.
Jenna!
He approaches the carriage house with caution, slowing his pace. Then Justin disappears inside. Noah reaches the doors and readies himself. Chapter 115. Noah peeks inside the carriage house. Justin is shining his flashlight around.
Shit,
he says. You don't know what shit.